Welcome, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of The Law of Self-Defense. Come on in. Make yourselves comfortable. I am, of course, attorney Andrew Branca for The Law of Self-Defense. So, today we are going to talk about this surprising things that can be used against you in court and closely related why whatever choice you make is always the wrong choice when it comes to court. So that'll be the topic for today and illustrate that with some anecdotes, one from a very recent case that brought the topic to mind. But of course, this is kind of a perennial evergreen topic for the law of self-defense community, but it's always good to be reminded of these real world dynamics of a criminal prosecution. So with that out of the way, let's go ahead and jump right into the formal start of today's show. And today's show is brought to us, to you, from me, by none other than Law of Self-Defense itself in the form of our free book, The Law of Self-Defense Principles, your handbook to being hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, your property. Check it out on Amazon. It's 5-star rated, folks, over, I think, 1,500 reviews, top seller in its category on Amazon. But don't buy it on Amazon. They'll charge you for the book and shipping and handling. I think it's $20 or $25 for the book on Amazon. We want to give you the book for free. We only ask that you cover the cost of shipping the book to you. You can get your own free copy of The Law of Self-Defense Principles at lawofselfdefense.com/freebook, or just scan the QR code there. I'll also leave that link up here underneath my name on the screen throughout the show, lawofselfdefense.com/freebook. All right, so what brought this topic to mind again was a recent verdict out of a Texas court involving a murder trial. There's a few lessons to draw from this murder trial, but one of those is surprising things that can be used against you in court and why whatever decision you make is always going to be the wrong decision. Forgot to turn off my notifications. There we go. So let me pull up this news story. Bump up the volume. There we go. Jury goes easy on pistol packer convicted of killing best friend stepdad. So there's so many people involved in this incident that I've gone through this news report and replaced their actual names with their categories. So defendant, victim, friend. Otherwise, it was very confusing to keep track of what was going on. But let's jump into this. So Rudo Isaiah Rudy Pardo, that was the defendant, has no criminal record, has apologized, and deserves sympathy. His attorney told the Bexar County, Texas jury that convicted him of murder for killing his best friend's stepfather. You see all the actors in this play. Jurors took just over 2 hours Thursday to sentence the defendant, 27, to 6 years in prison, 1 year more than the minimum term for the first degree felony. So one thing to note here is that there's very few U.S. states in which the jury has anything to do with sentencing. Normally, the jury's only involved in the guilt phase of a trial. They determine guilty or not guilty. After that, their job is done. They usually have no idea what the sentences are for the crime they're finding the defendant guilty of, and they're not supposed to know. They're instructed to not even take that into consideration should they happen to know. The one exception, if it's a death penalty case, that always has to be, capital punishment has to be affirmed by a jury everywhere. But in most states, the judge sentences. The jury has nothing to do with sentencing. Texas is one of those exceptions. Here, the jury made a determination on the sentence for this defendant. They could have chosen anything between 5 years and 99 years in prison. after finding him guilty of the crime of murder, and they chose to sentence him to 6 years. Continuing, the jury had taken more than 4 hours to find him guilty Wednesday in the fatal shooting of Kevin Osborne, henceforth victim, during a confrontation between the victim and his stepson, Pardo's friend. That would be Orion Herrera, who will be known here as Friend. Pardo, the defendant, had faced 5 to 99 years or life in prison. The defendant and his friend, Orion Herrera, both brought loaded handguns to a house on the west side where the victim had gone to seek his mother-in-law's help in patching up a fight with his wife early on February 19th, 2023. So many people. So they say the victim went to this house to get help in patching up a fight with his wife. In fact, the people in the house did not want him there. The people in the house called the defendant and the defendant's friend to the house to help keep the man who would be the victim out of the house. The friend was the victim's stepson. So the friend and the victim get into a chest-bumping confrontation in the driveway, and the defendant intervened. So getting into someone else's fight on behalf of his friend, right? That must be a good thing. The defendant testified that the victim punched him, that he pushed the victim back and fired one shot in self-defense when the victim kept advancing. So what do we have here? We have a traditional fistfight, which the courts will invariably treat as non-deadly force, absent aggravating factors like a disparity in size, strength, or fighting ability, or a weapon being displayed, or some exceptional vulnerability to harm. And that last one will come into play here. Generally speaking, you cannot use deadly force to stop a non-deadly force act of aggression. So generally speaking, you can't use a gun against a thrown fist absent one of those types of aggravating factors. The friend and the victim, let's see, already covered that. The friend testified with much the same story. By the way, the defendant testified, so he took the stand in his own defense. The friend testified with much the same story, except for the punching part. The victim was aggressive and made verbal threats, but was unarmed, he said. No punches were visible in video taken of the incident from surveillance cameras across the street at Memorial High School. So keep in mind, folks, there's almost always video these days. At least you have to presume there's almost always video. The victim's relatives were silent as visiting senior state district judge Lisa Jarrett, presiding by assignment, read the jury sentence. The person who was supposed to be the judge in this case recused themselves, and so this judge was appointed in their place. We'll see more of that in a moment. We lost a beloved family member and pillar of the community, Ernest Osborne said of his brother. The brother was the victim. The victim was a fixture in the Cadena Reeves Justice Center, that would be the courthouse, took selfies with many of the judges and lawyers, and often sat in on criminal trials because of his interest in the law. He sometimes took campaign photos of judges, and State District Judge Stephanie Boyd, whose court was assigned the case, recused herself because he had taken pictures of her and she considered him a friend. So many people loved the victim. He had an infectious smile that filled the room, the victim's brother said. The victim's brother told the defendant that he felt bad for him, that the victim's then wife was irresponsible and put defendant in danger by drawing him and his friend, the victim's stepson, into the night's dispute. You didn't need to be there, he told defendant. Two of the victim's nephews gave statements that also put blame on the victim's wife, who they said told lies about her husband and should have been charged along with the victim. So this is beginning to feel like a story where a woman got her man killed. Never happens, right? The defendant's friend, victim's stepson, testified that his mother called and instructed him to call her mother and tell her not to let the victim in her house. He told the jury he tried unsuccessfully to get a 911 dispatcher to send San Antonio police to see if he was there, so he enlisted the defendant's help and they both took their guns. Defendant testified that he suffered from psoriasis on 90% of his body and the victim's punches caused immense pain. So this is his lawyer's effort to get to some exceptional vulnerability to harm, one of those aggravating factors that could make a traditional fistfight into something more, something that might justify the use of deadly force in self-defense. Obviously, it didn't work, this argument, because the jury still found him guilty of murder. So clearly they decided it was not self-defense. I was trying to shoot in the abdomen or lower, higher leg, he testified Wednesday through tears. I didn't want the worst to happen. That was the defendant. Using an overhead projector, defense attorney Anton Hajik III showed the jury a hand-drawn chart that listed the number 5 with a dotted line to 99/life. Underneath 5 years, he wrote the word sympathy. Toward the top range, he wrote rehabilitation. So this is the defense attorney. I ask that you be sympathetic, the defense attorney told the jury before they deliberated the sentence. In his closing argument, prosecutor Jason Garahan told the jury that sentencing Pardo to the minimum would be highly inappropriate. I'm not going to compare this defendant to an axe murderer, Garahan told the panel. That's 99 years or life, but he took away the victim that day from his family. And here's the main point for today's show, folks. The prosecutor pointed out that the defendant and his friend carried guns without ever taking courses to learn to use them properly and to educate themselves on what constitutes self-defense. These are people walking around to choose who lives or dies, Garahan told the jury. Defendant is that individual, just like his friends, walking around with guns, not knowing the law. It's dangerous. The defendant will have to serve at least 3 years of the 50%, before he is eligible for parole. He received credit for time served in the Bexar County Jail. So, the bold part here. The prosecutor pointed out the defendant and his friends carried guns without ever taking courses to learn to use them properly and to educate themselves on what constitutes self-defense. He didn't get my book. Oh, no. This defendant didn't get my book. He should have gotten the book. He probably would have kept him from killing somebody that day. But the question for all of you folks is, what do you think this prosecutor would have said to the jury if this defendant had read my book? What do you think the prosecutor would have said to this jury if this defendant had taken shooting classes with a handgun? Well, then what he would have said is, this defendant planned for years to use this gun to kill. After all, he took all those shooting courses to make sure everything would go right, and that he'd fire a fatal shot into this poor victim. And if he'd read my book, taken one of my courses, watched my content, the prosecutor would have said, yeah, sure, this defendant, he knew what to say to the police, and he knew what to say to you when he testified, because he'd prepared to kill. He'd prepared his legal defense before he ever showed up there that night. That's how he knew the magic words to say. But it's all a fabrication. Of course, that's what he would say. That's what they always say. Whatever your choice is, it's the wrong choice. So if the question is ever, can X be used against me in court? The answer is always yes. Yes, it can. A great example of this was in the opening statement by the prosecution in the George Zimmerman case. Got a little video clip here. We're going to hear from prosecutor John Guy, one of four prosecutors in the Zimmerman trial. He did the opening for the state of Florida. And he's going to talk about the fact that George Zimmerman didn't just have a gun when he encountered Trayvon Martin that night. Let's hear what he had to say.
There was this defendant riding around in his car, not with candy, not with fruit juice, but with a Kel-Tec 9mm semi-automatic pistol in a ready-to-fire position, meaning there was one live round in the chamber.
All right. There was a live round in the chamber. George Zimmerman was carrying a Kel-Tec 9mm semi-automatic pistol. Sometimes John Guy would refer to it as a Kel-Tec instead of a Kel-Tec. Kel-Tec being the manufacturer, of course. with in the ready to fire position with a round in the chamber. Oh, no. Oh, no. Folks, everyone who carries a gun for personal protection has a round in the chamber. I, right now, am carrying a gun for personal protection. There's a round in the chamber. Every bailiff in that courtroom was armed with a service pistol with a round in the chamber. Indeed, in this particular fight, had George Zimmerman not had a round in the chamber, he probably would have died because he was only able, on his back, getting his head beaten into a sidewalk with Trayvon Martin mounted on top of him, beating him, pound and ground style, according to an eyewitness who testified at the trial, creating an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury, as the medical expert testified at trial. George Zimmerman screaming for help, and nobody came. Desperately trying to hold off Trayvon Martin with his left hand, pulled his pistol single-handed with his right hand and fired the one shot that saved his life. If he'd had to cycle that slide to put around the chamber, he probably wouldn't have survived that attack by Trayvon Martin. So is it ridiculous for the prosecutor to claim that there's something wrong with George Zimmerman having had a round in the chamber of a pistol he was carrying for personal protection? No, that's the way it's done. Everybody who takes a self-defense pistol course is trained to carry in just that way. But was he allowed to talk about that as if there was something wrong with doing that to a naive jury who probably doesn't carry guns, doesn't actually know what the standard practice is for this? Sure he is. He's allowed to talk about anything. You may remember in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, Kyle Rittenhouse had loaded his AR rifle with ball ammo, meaning it's not hollow point. It's a solid slug, essentially. And the prosecutor there, Prosecutor Binger, went on at length about how that was the wrong choice. That was the wrong choice because ball ammo, because it does not expand in the target, can overpenetrate, can ricochet down the street, can be a reckless threat to innocent bystanders. A responsible defender, a reasonable defender, would have used hollow point ammo to minimize the reckless endangerment of innocent people. What do you think Prosecutor Binger would have argued if Kyle Rittenhouse had loaded his AR with hollow point ammo that expanded in the target? He would have said, well, this defendant, a reasonable defender, would have used ball ammo, but he wanted to make sure his targets were dead. He used rounds that are designed to expand within the body like a bomb and ensure a fatal injury. Whatever choice Kyle Rittenhouse would have made would have been the wrong choice. In this case out of Texas we just read about, this defendant, he never took a pistol course. He never learned what the law of self-defense was. If he had taken those things, the prosecutor would have used that against him. Anything can be used against you. If the question is, can X be used against me in court? The answer is always yes. In terms of your training, another fascinating part of the George Zimmerman trial was before his encounter with Trayvon Martin in months and years prior, George Zimmerman had allowed himself to get pretty fat. And he decided he didn't like that anymore. He wanted to get fit. So he joined a gym. And he joined an MMA gym where they teach mixed martial arts, self-defense, ring fighting, that kind of stuff. You think the prosecutor used that against George Zimmerman? Saying, hey, listen, maybe a defender normally, under normal circumstances, would have been privileged to use a gun to defend themselves against Trayvon Martin, but not this defendant, not this defendant, not George Zimmerman. Because George Zimmerman was a trained MMA fighter. He didn't need to resort to a gun. It wasn't actually necessary for him to use a gun to defend himself from this 17-year-old kid. He had the fighting skills to defend himself without having to use a gun, and therefore the use of the gun was unreasonable, unnecessary, and unlawful. Well, sounds reasonable. And the truth is, folks, is that you're going to be judged by a jury based on what a reasonable and prudent person would have done in your circumstances who's in possession of the skills that you have. If it's true that you have exceptional fighting skills, you'll be judged by that standard. And it's hard to argue that you shouldn't be. Fortunately for Zimmerman, the defense brought in the owner of this MMA gym, put him on the witness stand, and they asked the owner, how long was George a member of your gym? And it was something like 12 weeks. And they said, well, when he first got there, on a scale of 1 to 10, what would you say George Zimmerman's fighting ability was? And the owner of the gym laughed and said, well, like a 1. And they said, and after this 12 weeks of training at your gym, after all that, what would you say George Zimmerman's fighting ability was on a scale of 1 to 10? And the gym owner goes, 1.5? So it completely gutted this prosecutor's attempt to use Zimmerman's MMA training against them. But were they allowed to try to use it against him in court? Sure. And they did try to use it against him in court. If the question is, can X be used against me in court? We have to understand what used against me in court really means. It means, can the prosecutor talk about this in an effort to make me look bad in front of the jury? The answer to that's always yes. You have to presume that the prosecutor will be allowed to talk about anything in an effort to make you look bad in front of the jury. Now, technically, there's things that you can get excluded or hopefully get excluded, but you never know ahead of time what a trial judge is going to allow or not allow as evidence. I mean, we just saw the Harvey Weinstein conviction get overturned by the New York Supreme Court. They don't call it Supreme Court in New York. Their highest level court is the Court of Appeals. That's the name for their highest level court. It's a little odd, but that's the way they do it. But they reversed Harvey Weinstein's conviction because the trial judge had allowed in a lot of evidence that should not have been permitted in. But the prosecution in that case asked for that inappropriate evidence to be allowed before the jury, and the trial judge allowed it. And Harvey Weinstein got convicted. Now, the reversal of his conviction doesn't mean that the appellate court doesn't think he's guilty. That's not the question they decided. They may very well think he is guilty. But if you're going to be found guilty, you have to be found guilty with due process of law. Justice is not about the outcome in a case, folks. Justice is about the process of the case. And if the process is corrupted, you have no justice. You can have no confidence in the legitimacy of whatever the verdict was. And all of us are entitled to due process of law. If we deny it to the worst of us, and Harvey Weinstein, by reputation at least, is pretty bad, if we deny it to the worst of us, that means we're going to be denying it to the best of us, to all of us. So even the worst of us are entitled to due process of law. That's all the Court of Appeals in New York was saying in reversing this conviction. I expect Harvey Weinstein will be tried again. But hopefully this time, with appropriate due process and without inappropriate evidence being admitted against them. So, now, the question may arise, but Andrew, what if I studied jiu-jitsu like I do? What if I take pistol courses for self-defense? What if I enjoy that, right? Sometimes we call it, and shooting guns on a range and taking these courses can be a lot of fun. Sometimes it's called entertainment because the training is also entertainment. What if I read your book or take your courses? Certainly you advocate that we do that, right? You give the book away for free. Can that be used against me in court? And the answer is yes. If by that you mean, will a prosecutor be allowed to attempt to use that in an effort to make you look bad? Sure, he will. But the question is twofold. First of all, but what's the alternative? Are you not going to get trained in how to use a gun? Are you not going to learn the law of self-defense? Because we just saw in this Texas case, that gets used against you too. So I would suggest if it's going to be used against you regardless, you may as well get the training you need to be proficient with your gun or whatever your self-defense methodology of choice is. So you maximize the prospects of winning the physical fight. And if you don't win that, everything else is less pressing, right? The physical fight has to be the top priority. And if you don't learn the actual law of self-defense, what are you relying on luck? Or worse, are you relying on misinformation on what you're legally permitted to do in self-defense and be within the bounds of the law? Because most of the information out there on self-defense law is bad information, folks. So most of the cases I consult on, I'm consulting on one right now, which is why the live stream content is a little intermittent this week. It's not that I'm not working, folks. I'm working my butt off, but I'm working for on a client matter. Most of the cases I work on, if you put the defendant on a lie detector test and ask him, did you use force within the legal boundaries? Were you acting in lawful self-defense? They'd say yes, and they'd pass that lie detector test. They believe it. In fact, they can't believe they're getting prosecuted for self-defense. But the truth is, they didn't actually know where the legal boundaries were. They had no idea. They may have thought they knew, but they were mistaken. They were misinformed. They were literally ignorant of where the legal boundaries actually were. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean that in a technical sense, that they simply were unknowing of where the legal boundaries were. And often they step over those legal boundaries with complete innocence, no malice, no intention to do anything unlawful. But the law doesn't care what you thought the legal boundaries were. The law only cares what the legal boundaries actually are. And if you step over those, that's fatal to your claim of self-defense. So I would suggest the alternative to, will X be used against me in court? Will my self-defense training, will my legal instruction be used against me in court? The answer is not to stay ignorant and incapable of defending yourself. That's foolish. The answer is to become proficient in self-defense. Be prepared to win that physical fight and be prepared to win the legal fight. Now, the second question in all of this is, after, should I just remain ignorant or should I actually become trained and educated? I hope you choose the latter there. The second question is, well, is it fatal that the prosecutor is going to use whatever choice you made, whatever you do, however you're trained and not trained, is it fatal to your defense that the prosecutor is going to attempt to use that against you in court? And the answer is, well, it depends. It depends, because we have to consider not just will they attempt to use it, they will attempt to use it, whatever it is, but how damaging is it likely to be? And how readily can your defense lawyer mitigate whatever damage there might be? Some things are really damaging and hard to mitigate. But things like getting educated, getting trained, they're not. In fact, this argument we just saw by John Guy in the George Zimmerman case, that he had a round in the chamber in the ready-to-fire position, to my recollection, the defense didn't even bother addressing that remark because they perceived it as so inconsequential. Addressing it might simply have reinforced it in the minds of the jury. But there are things that can be damaging. If you engrave on the muzzle of your pistol, watch for flash, or kill them all, let God sort them out, or you put a Punisher backplate on your Glock, who's the Punisher? He's a vigilante. He uses force outside the legal limits. That's his purpose in life. Is that who you think you are? Because you're telling the jury that's who you think you are. Your Glock didn't come with that Punisher backplate on it. You put that there. That goes to your state of mind, a malicious state of mind, that you're beyond the law. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask you to show this defendant that he is not beyond the law and find him guilty. If you have signs up on your house, trespassers will be shot, survivors will be shot again. You can't shoot someone for simple trespass, folks, not lawfully. I guess physically you can, but it would be an unlawful killing. You got signs up saying we don't call 911. Why not? Well, how do you think that sounds to a jury? Now, we know these things are jokes. You think a prosecutor is going to present it to a jury as if it were a joke or as if it's representative of your malicious state of mind? You don't call 911 because you take justice into your own hands. You shoot trespassers because you feel you're entitled to do that. The law doesn't say you're entitled to do that. You feel you're beyond the law. You're willing to take human life, even when it's illegal to do that, because you're special. So that kind of stuff can be damaging. The stuff that concerns me is the stuff that can be presented to the jury as evidence of some malicious state of mind on your part, some willingness to go beyond the legal boundaries. So don't do that stuff. Don't have those signs. Don't put weird stuff on your guns. You want to present to a jury as boring as possible. And your gun, your defensive tools, a knife, whatever, should be as boring as possible. I was just talking to a friend of mine, really nice guy, very responsible, very well trained in self-defense, very familiar with my self-defense law instruction. And he took out his knife and showed it to me. This is the knife he carries for personal protection. And it's a knife that's really designed for personal protection, meaning it's got the blade has a very odd, like curved shape to it, very unusual shape. And I imagine it would be extremely effective in defending yourself against lethal attack. But it looks horrific. I mean, you put that in front of a jury, that's going to be presented to a jury as a knife, the only purpose of which is to take human life. I think it was actually designed explicitly for that purpose. But I don't tell people what to do, so I wouldn't tell someone not to carry a knife like that. But just be aware that's how it's going to be presented to a jury. A more traditionally shaped folding knife or even a fixed blade knife, harder to present as something designed just to kill. So I generally advise that people keep their defensive options as boring as possible. Consistent with safety, of course. You have to be equipped to win that physical fight. But don't be unnecessarily, dramatic. Don't. I've seen carry ammo that's labeled, I'll make something up. I don't want to get sued by any ammo company, but like, sometimes you see these companies come out with this weird ammo and it's branded like Life Taker 2000. It's like, don't carry ammo like that. How do you think that's going to be presented to a jury? I generally recommend find out whatever your local police department issues or what the FBI issues. Last time I looked, that was Gold Dot. Yeah, rip ammo. Rip ammo. Rest in peace ammo. I wouldn't even carry ammo that just aesthetically, sometimes they're designed to look particularly ferocious, like sharpened bullets and stuff. Last I checked, the FBI was issuing Gold Dot. That's what I carry for personal protection. Stay as boring as you can. All right. So, can X be used against you in court? Yeah, it can. If by used against you in court, we mean, can it be spoken about in front of the jury in an effort to make you look bad? Then I don't care what X is. Whatever it is, the prosecutor will try to do it. Keep in mind, if you're in court as a defendant, that prosecutor is in it to win it. He's not there to lose. If he thought he was going to lose, you probably wouldn't be there. He thinks he can win, and he's going to use all his talents, all his rhetorical abilities, and unfortunately, more often than I'd like to see, pushing well beyond what I would consider ethical boundaries for a prosecutor to secure your conviction. Important to have really competent defense counsel who can mount the counterarguments to this kind of rhetorical nonsense when it's necessary and appropriate to do that. Hey, Steve Gosney's in the chat. Hey, Steve, how you doing, man? Steve Gosney, public defender, appellate division, Florida. You can check out his books at stevegosney.com. He's got many, many excellent books. Some of them are rather technical, legal books. Some of them kind of coming-of-age books. Some of them 50 Shades of Grey type of books. What's the most recent one, Steve? Death Penalty Desires. Check them out at stevegosney.com. Death Penalty Desires. That's right. All right, folks. I don't think I have much more for all of you today. Let me take a look at the comments. Of course, member comments get answered for free if you're a Law Self-Defense member. And if you're not a Law Self-Defense member, I have to ask, why not? You can become a member for 99 cents, folks. That's a 2-week trial membership at lawofselfdefense.com/trial. 99 cents to try it out for 2 weeks. you get things like transcripts of every show. You get access to documents we reference, videos we reference. Lots of great stuff. At least try it out for 99 cents. After the two-week trial, it's still dirt cheap. It's only about 30 cents a day, less than $10 a month to be a Law of Self-Defense member at lawofselfdefense.com/trial. Let me pull over the member chat here. Let's see. By the way, we also see cases, of course, where the judges are apparently insane. I'm sure the members in the chat are aware or may have mentioned that we have this case out of New York where a man engaged in what looks to me to be perfectly lawful gunsmithing practices ran afoul of one of the fascist New York State gun control laws. And when his defense attorney tried to argue that whatever New York State law may have said was illegal here, his conduct's legal under the Second Amendment to the Constitution, and that trumps New York State law. And the judge said, I don't want to hear about the Second Amendment. This is New York State. Second Amendment doesn't exist here. Crazy. And he got convicted. And I'm sure, you know, the sentencing for gun law violations in New York are horrific. So I'm sure he got sentenced. Maybe he hasn't been sentenced yet. Often there's a time gap between conviction and sentencing, but I'm sure he's looking at a lot of years. Let's see. Will Parker, firearms instructor up in Montana. Check him out at, do I still have a banner for Will? I do. Check Will out at, well, that's his email. But his website is fmgw.com. Will is teaching is hosting a class in August being taught by my good buddy, T.C. Fuller, best man at my wedding. T.C. Fuller is a retired federal law enforcement officer, spent much of his adult years a very active competitive shooter. T.C. and I traveled to and shot many matches together, national level matches. Master level shooter. And August 10th and 11th, he's teaching a class being hosted by Will Parker up in the Kalispell area of Montana. I think the 10th is sold out, but I believe last I heard there were still seats on Sunday the 11th. And I'll be there. I'm traveling through Montana, doing a motorcycle trip up into British Columbia. And I'll be a range officer, a safety officer for Will and TC for both of those days, Saturday and Sunday. So you get to meet me personally, too. If you'd like more information on Will's classes up there, just email him there at will@fmgw.com. That's going to be a fun weekend. Hanging out with friends and shooting guns. What more can you ask for? And then hopping on a motorcycle and riding through British Columbia for a couple of weeks. Very much looking forward to that. Anyway, Will mentioned to me the other day that he got retained as an expert witness. Will, by the way, is a graduate of the Law of Self-Defense Instructor Program. Very well trained on self-defense law, as all the graduates of the instructor program are, because you don't get certified as a graduate unless you pass a very rigorous final exam, if you're interested in that. This is the equivalent of a law school semester seminar in self-defense law, if any law school taught this stuff at that level, which to my knowledge, none of them do, but fortunately I do. And you can learn more about that at lawofselfdefense.com/instructor. It's not for everybody. It's a very rigorous course of instruction, but you will know your self-defense law and a lot about criminal law and criminal procedure, due process generally, by the end of that instructor program, if that's of interest to you. So Will got retained as an expert witness on a use of force case. And he mentions here, 7 months after the incident, the person who was shot died. Uh-oh. So now, of course, the criminal charge, which was probably something like aggravated battery, use of a gun against someone to cause injury without fatal result, now will be a manslaughter or murder charge because the victim has died. I don't know the specific law. Well, I don't even know where Will's doing the consulting, but in many states, if you cause injury to someone and they die within a year afterwards, it's legally presumed that it's your injury that caused the death. It's a rebuttable presumption. I mean, if they get hit by a car, obviously it's the car that killed them. But very awkward. Let's see. Yeah, the autopsy will be key in charges being increased, right? Let's see. Cycle Boy says, so chicks that go to kickbox cardio are now trained fighters too. I mean, if the question is, can a prosecutor make that argument to a jury? The answer is yes. Lawful to shoot. Prosecutor, can they say, so it's true that you have a membership with law of self-defense, so you're hard to kill and hard to convict, just like it says on the mug, folks. Get your mug at lawofselfdefense.com/mug. So you're hard to kill, hard to convict, and so it's therefore true that you planned to murder someone, believing you won't be able to be convicted. Can a prosecutor make that argument? Almost certainly, yes. I mean, it's not a very compelling argument, because guess who else is also trained, supposedly, in the law of self-defense in that courtroom? Well, the prosecutor, right? He has to overcome the defendant's claim of self, legal claim of self-defense. Hopefully, your defense attorney has trained themselves on self-defense law. And the judge is supposed to be the legal expert in the courtroom. In a self-defense case, that would include self-defense law. Are they all killers? Are they all planning to murder someone? Jim asks, so if this defendant in Texas who just got convicted of murder and sentenced to 6 years, if he had taken your course and read your book, do you think he would have fired? I doubt it. Yeah, I doubt it too. I mean, if he just listens to my content generally, hopefully he wouldn't have been there. Most of the our law of self-defense community, especially our platinum members, have an extraordinarily low incidence of finding themselves engaged in a conflict where they're compelled to use especially deadly force in self-defense. Because they bother to think about this stuff on a very deep level, get educated on the actual legal boundaries, and are very sensitive to prospective threats in their environment. Johnny Reb says, could you do a breakdown of the George Allen Kelly Arizona Rancher on the Border murder trial and where the interview went wrong? I don't think I've seen an interview about that case. I guess he was interrogated by police. I haven't looked at any of the evidence in that case. So I'm generally aware that Kelly, Arizona rancher, says he saw several men armed with long guns crossing his property. He's right on the border with Mexico. And he says he fired some warning shots, a warning shot, called police. Eventually, the cops show up and they find a dead body with a bullet in it. I don't think the bullet was ever recovered, but they argued that Kelly shot someone for being a simple trespasser, which is not legal in Arizona or any other state, and they prosecuted him for murder. His trial just a day or two ago, earlier this week, just ended in a mistrial. The jury could not come to a unanimous verdict. I think on Monday, the prosecutor is supposed to announce whether or not he's going to retry Kelly. The problem, the difficulty for Kelly is if you say I fired a warning shot and then they find a body with a bullet in it, well, it doesn't look like a warning shot if it's your bullet that killed that person. Now, of course, that's ambiguous here. The Kelly defense says, well, it wasn't our client's bullet that killed that person. He must have been killed by, you know, cartel gunmen or something. The trouble is there's no cartel gunmen on trial or identified or arrested or interrogated. So it's speculative, that explanation for this dead person with a bullet within proximity to Kelly's home. But they know for sure that Kelly fired a bullet because he said he did. That's, yeah. Now, I don't know if Kelly, you know, told police he fired a warning shot before he was ever aware that there was a dead person. To connect the warning shot to, maybe he said it on the 911 call. Maybe he said it when he first encountered police and wasn't aware there was a dead person. Maybe the police weren't immediately aware there was a dead person. But in any case, that's his dilemma. I didn't watch the trial, and I don't think I'll watch it retrospectively now. I'm going to wait at least until I find out whether he's going to be retried. If he's going to be retried, I'll have to, if I can fit it in my schedule, I'll consider live streaming his retrial. It's not a self-defense case, though, folks. So, and I have a lot of commitments this year because of we're moving from Colorado. We got to visit a lot of different locations and schools and all that kind of stuff. So, Psycho Boy says, the DA, isn't it true you chose to eat Cheetos and drink full sugar Cokes? You'd be a flabby mess with a heart condition, and therefore you could claim to have be exceptionally vulnerable to injury and therefore use deadly force in self-defense. They can say anything, folks. Steve says, Steve Gosney's got a quote here. Can I shoot him yet? I don't know what that's a quote from. Is that from Kelly in Arizona? Let's see. Steve Gosney. I heard about that. I had a judge say something similar in a case I had about the First Amendment. This is all going to get worse, folks. This is all going to get worse. If you only knew what law schools were like today, you would be horrified. These law students are being trained not to apply legal reasoning to arguments, but to make a emotional, intersectional, race-based, gender-based arguments. And all those law students, eventually they graduate and they become prosecutors or defense attorneys. And then if they hang around long enough, some of them become judges. And then we get this judge, like in New York, who says the Second Amendment doesn't apply in New York. Dan says, I carry a Glock 26. It's about as standard as you can get for this very reason right here. Great point, Andrew. Yeah, be boring, folks. Psycho Boy, engrave your knife with for utility and defense purposes only. Offensive use prohibited. There, it's non-scary. I don't even like serrated blades on the fence knives for that purpose. Again, I'm not telling anybody what to do, but let's see. Bup. A lot of comments today for a relatively short show. Steve Gosney says, Andrew, did you see the law of self-defense principles in the chapter, The Robbery? Will Parker was my model for the average gun guy in the novel for a defensive use of firearm scene. That would have been in Death Penalty Desires. I did see that. Yes. Thank you, Steve. What's the most common self-defense myth? Big O asks. Can you call it a myth? I mean, there's so many. One of my big ones is better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6. I mean, of course, in a very superficial sense, that's true, right? You'd rather be on trial for use of force than dead in the street. The lie is that those are your only two options, in part. It's not, you don't have to position yourself for that fate for either of those. But also, the lie is it's kind of built on a premise that, well, everything will go fine with the jury. And I'm like, have you seen a jury, an actual jury? Have you seen some of these verdicts we're getting out of juries today? Keep in mind, folks, by definition, the average IQ is 100. 100. That means half the population is below 100 IQ. They get on juries, too. We live in a social media era where it's not just law students. All people are being conditioned to view the world through an emotional lens. Reason and rationality are devalued today. It's all about how people feel. That's a dangerous jury, especially when you're asking them to consider, technical legal arguments, elements of crimes and legal defenses, things like constraining themselves to not finding a defendant guilty unless the prosecution has proven them guilty beyond any reasonable doubt. Most juries, in my opinion, they arrive at their verdicts based on a preponderance evidence. Do they think it's more likely than not this guy did it? That's not the legal standard. It's not even close. And people's spending decades in a cage rely on the jury doing it right. Cycle Boy says, warning shots are reckless shots. Almost always. I mean, I can envision circumstances in which a warning shot would not be reckless. If you're on a boat on the open sea, I suppose you could argue that there is nobody around to be endangered recklessly by your warning shot. Maybe, you know, I don't know what Kelly's property looks like, but I've ridden my motorcycle through Arizona and large parts of it. There's nothing for miles. So maybe if that's what the terrain looks like, you could argue that a warning shot is not recklessly endangering anybody. But for most of us who live in normal places and normal communities, if you fire a gun, bullets don't miss. They may miss your intended target, but they keep going until they hit something. And bullets fired into the air, just into the air, up into the sky, when they come down, they often kill people. Steve Gosney says, some states allow pre-arrest silence to be commented on. Yeah, that's true. Certainly federal law says it can be. So the state would have to be more protective of the defendant than federal law. And it's often the standard. I mean, the standard under federal law basically is until the moment you're either really mirandized or asserted, until the moment you're being interrogated as a suspect, custodial interrogation, anything you say up to that point can be used against you. I mean, at that point, you need to be mirandized and made aware of your rights. And then if you keep talking, that can be used against you too. In the context of silence, once you've been mirandized or you have asserted your right to silence, after that point, definitely your silence cannot be used against you, cannot be mentioned to a jury. He didn't tell us what happened. He just sat there. That can't be used against you after you've either been mirandized or you've affirmatively, unambiguously asserted your right to silence. But in many states and under federal law prior to that, if you're silent, the state's allowed to talk about that to the jury. We rolled up on the scene, jumped out of our patrol car, bunch of people standing around. We asked, what happened? Why is this person dead on the ground? And this defendant was there and he didn't say a word to us about it. Often admissible, unless the state in question is more protective than the federal government. And if you do say something and you don't include what later is your defense, that can look particularly bad. That happened with Nikolai Mew, right? He ended up talking to the investigators at the police station and before when he was under arrest in the patrol car. And he mostly just dissembled. He made up stories and stuff. So he said words, but he never said self-defense. And that failure was used against him at trial for sure. Yep, Steve Gosney says there are way too many exceptions to Miranda. Answer to any Miranda question, I want to remain silent. I want my lawyer present. Then stick with it. And you need to be that unambiguous, folks. If you say, well, I'm thinking I need a lawyer, or, you know, I don't know if I should say anything without a lawyer present, that's not an assertion of your rights, legally speaking. It has to be unambiguous. And as Steve says, you have to stick to it. And by the way, the cops, you know, we cover a lot of police interrogations at the Law of Self-Defense. The cops are very clever about convincing people or allowing people to convince themselves to talk with them after they've been Mirandized, told they don't have to talk, told they can have a lawyer present, told they can assert their rights at any time, stop talking at any time. That's one of the things the cops will say, by the way, to make it sound like, hey, it's not a big deal. You know, I mean, you don't have to talk to us. That's up to you. You know, but if you'd like to, you know, give us your side of the story, and keep in mind, just like we were just read you on the Miranda card, you're still free to assert your rights anytime you want. So what's the harm? What's the harm? What's the harm is you talk yourself into a prison sentence. That's the harm. They're very low key and relaxed about it. It's just a formality, just a technicality. Sign this waiver. Sign this, you know, form saying that you've been Mirandized and you understand these rights. Like, how would they really understand their rights? You have to go to law school to understand these rights. And even then, you may not understand them very well. They don't understand their rights. As Steve says, I assert my right to silence. I assert my right to counsel, period. And then stick with it. So I've seen cases. So you assert your right to silence and your right to counsel, and the police are not supposed to interrogate you anymore. And without your lawyer present, for sure. The conversation is supposed to stop. But I've seen cases where what the cops will do is they'll stop asking you questions, but they'll start chattering amongst themselves within earshot of you. You can hear their conversation. And Officer Joe and Officer Tom will be talking about, hey, Tom, what do you think happened here? Well, Joe, it looks to me like this suspect is just a racist murderer. And of course, a lot of defendants will say, whoa, that's not true. I'm not a racist murderer, and start talking. And then they've effectively waived their right to silence because they've initiated the conversation with the police officers. So just don't do that. Will Parker says another important question. Am I being detained or am I free to go? Yeah, don't let that remain ambiguous. I mean, they may tell you you're being detained, and then, of course, you have to comply. Physically comply, but that doesn't mean be subservient. That doesn't mean they're the, you know, you have to answer all their questions. You have your rights, assert them. Let's see. Yeah, I see a lot of cases. A lot of cases. I mean, big ones. Nikolai Mew, Helena Hutchins, Alec Baldwin. All allowing themselves to be interrogated by police without lawyers present and all talking themselves into prison. I mean, we don't know with Alec Baldwin yet, of course. His trial's coming up in July, but those interviews he gave police are not helpful to him. Very damaging. All right, so if you're not a law of self-defense member, I do answer questions on YouTube, but they need to be a $10 super chat. Hopefully I've trained people away from doing that. Why spend $10 a question when you can be a law of self-defense member for 99 cents and get all your questions answered for free? But I do leave it as an option. Some people seem to prefer that. Fortunately, there are none today. Good. I'm glad to see that. Let me... All right, don't forget, folks, our free book, real physical book, Law of Self-Defense Principles, bestseller on Amazon, but don't buy it there. They'll charge you for the book. I want to give you the book for free at lawofselfdefense.com/freebook. Your handbook to being hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, your property. Folks, if all you do is read this book, which you can get for free, you've enormously reduced your risk of conviction if you're involved in a use of force event. Enormously. Now, it's never zero. That's why we teach more. And if you haven't taken this simple step, I mean, most people tell us that they read this book in an afternoon. It's not complicated. It's very easy to read. That was the hardest part of producing that book, actually, was the editing process. We made it very easy to read. It's all in plain English. If you don't take even that step, I mean, what are you really doing to be hard to convict? Nothing? Prison sucks, folks. And you don't know when the fight's coming to you. That's not up to you. That's up to the bad guy. The bad guy chooses the time, place, and manner of attack. It's your job just to be ready. To be ready to win that physical fight and to be ready to win the legal fight that follows the physical. Can't make it cheaper than free, folks. lawofselfdefense.com/freebook. We only ask you cover the cost that we have to pay for shipping the book to you. All right, folks, with that out of the way, oh my gosh, we went an hour. I thought this was going to be a half hour show. All right. I'll just remind all of you, if you carry a gun so you're hard to kill, Carry a knife so you're hard to kill. Carry pepper spray. Study Brazilian jiu-jitsu so you're hard to kill. I do all those things so that I'm hard to kill. My family is hard to kill. If you do any of that, so you and your family are hard to kill, you also owe it to yourself and your family to make sure you know the law so you're hard to convict as well. Until next time, probably Monday. Until next time, I remain attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.